one into the night. Deep into right. Way out of here.
Swung on.
Bit crushed.
And the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
From WHYY, welcome to your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. I'm Justin Clue, I write for Baseball Prospectus, and I'm the author of Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were doing while Joe DiMaggio was making history. Hey, your dad wants it for Father's Day. He told me. So if you want to check that out, I'd make sure you pick that up. It's available now. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin. And I could say my father loves it, and I bet your father will too.
Dad approved on this end, so
Dad
balls
approved.
In your court. Sorry
yes,
for
exactly.
using cross sports metaphors hey, there. That's probably confusing.
The French Open is happening right now, so It is appropriate. I'm fine. The weather is lovely, and I'm a happy woman.
Well, I think we're all pretty happy after that series in San Diego, where the Phillies swept the Padres, outscoring them, well, merely 10-3. We'll talk about that in a minute. But they did finish the job in San Diego, despite having an Aaron Nola start, despite Jesus Luzardo looking shaky a little early on, despite not really scoring a ton. But Liz, they lost two series in a row coming into the San Diego series they just played in starting on Monday. And those three teams, the Reds and Guardians, both of whom the Phillies lost series to before playing the Padres, are the only teams the Phillies have played under Don Mattingly that are over 500. So it was starting to set a bad precedent, it kind of felt, that they were losing series after winning like six of them in a row to the first teams they were running into who are over 500. And then they meet the Padres, who at the time were in second place behind only the Dodgers in the National League West. Obviously, we know the Padres well. Phillies have been playing the Padres. Feels like, you know, in the playoffs, obviously, in 2022. But, you know, they are a team that has been competitive for some time. And the Phillies, well, as we're also going to talk about, have typically taken care of business. And they certainly did so here. So, Liz, what was your general thinking coming into this? Were you kind of backing off the juice the Phillies seemed to have after they lost two series to the Reds and Guardians? Did you think this was now trouble? Because we'd been looking forward to this West Coast swing, a chance for the Phillies to play against some really competitive teams while they seemed to be at their hottest.
I wasn't all that concerned, if only because my feeling about Ohio is that it's a crap state with crap baseball. And the sooner they got out of there, the better. And so they... out of Ohio, better for them. For me, I always have great memories of the Phillies going on the West Coast. Like, I remember in like 2010 or 2011, they had like a ridiculous West Coast swing, like the end of July, early August, where they won like 11 of 12 games. It was one of their most successful road trips in franchise history at that time. And so I love when they go on the West Coast, except for the fact that the games are on late and I am a big baby. I'm a 42-year-old woman who gets tired early.
Well, I think taking this team out for a test drive in its new fully primed form was going to be at least an interesting test. John Stolness and I had talked about how, boy, it'd be great to see this team playing at this level, take on that two-week stretch of Braves and Cubs opponents that was so devastating for them earlier in the year. So it was a little shaky, I felt, coming out to San Diego. Things kind of not going as smoothly as they had been, but the Phillies rebounded. And as you said, I mean, the Padres don't, I'm not scared of a good Padres team. And I was trying to figure out why. And the answer is because despite the Padres being good this year, you know, filling in second place behind the Dodgers until the Phillies just knocked them into third. Since 2022, the Phillies are 20-9 against the Padres in the regular season. That includes this three-game sweep. It does not include the postseason, in which the Phillies also went through them to win a National League pennant. So even a good Padres team isn't a tough match for this Phillies team. They seem to find a way to be effective out there. Kyle Schwarber hits very well in San Diego historically.
Oh, yeah.
That continued. And, you know, this was in general, I feel, exactly what you wanted to see as the Phillies started to drop a couple more games. And, hey, man, I think what we saw in this series was pretty encouraging, despite the Phillies totaling only 18 hits. 21 Major League Baseball teams had more than that in the same span from Monday to Wednesday. The Phillies hit 194 against the Padres. They did hit six home runs. There are 10 teams that hit at least five home runs from Monday to Wednesday. The Phillies are the only one to have done that and also hit under 200 as a team. This is very Phillies.
Exciting.
This is how you know they are operating at full capacity because, yes,
as they should be.
That's their makeup. You know? Like that's, yeah. I wish they were getting better.
If stats don't make sense, that means it's working.
I wish they were hitting better, and I think they can, certainly. But there's no denying that there's a couple of offensive success stories here. You know, there's always at least a couple of somebodies who could be hitting better or that you'd like to see hitting better. But Schwarber and Harper, we know, have been on a tear this season. Stott and Marsh are hitting lefties. Newsflash. Trey Turner, you know, people have been waiting for him to get started. He hit a couple to the moon in San Diego as well. So, you know, that was encouraging, you might say. They did strike out 14 times, which is the second fewest amount of strikeouts from Monday to Wednesday in Major League Baseball. So, you know, on one end and the other of the scale. And they had one at bat with the bases loaded and went 0-for-1. And despite this, like I said, they did sweep the series. Which did include this fun moment in Game 3. Padres reliever Adrian Morejon caught a Bryce Harper line drive that came right back to the mound, and he then dramatically spiked it into the mound to the delight of the home Padres crowd. He did this despite having let up a run that inning in a series that the Padres had already lost, because again, they had lost the first two coming into Game 3. So maybe we could just chalk that one up to adrenaline or something. I don't know. It certainly hasn't been living in my head since I saw it. But here's the thing, guys. If the Phillies are going to pitch like they did in San Diego, they barely need to score at all.
Yeah, Jesus, that's what I was saying. That's what I was thinking coming into today's episode.
I mean, obviously, again, anytime you want to come out and score 6-8 runs, I will welcome that. I don't think I'm the only one who will welcome that. But yeah, if you can get this kind of pitching, which is, again, how this team is built, to rely on its starting pitching, then you don't have to put so much pressure on yourself to score a comfortable amount of runs. Unfortunately, I feel like that sets a bad precedent. But regardless, this is how the team functions. Jesus Luzardo allowed 4 hits, 2 walks, no earned runs over 6 innings in San Diego. Aaron Nola, who I spent most of this series that I was actually out in San Diego for, explaining that if they're going to lose a game, it'll probably be this one. And in fact, when Trey Turner misplayed a ball that allowed an inning to continue during Aaron Nola's start, I did call the subsequent Manny Machado home run that would follow because it was the perfect amount of chaotic energy and that Nola had been pitching pretty well. The runner on base in the continuation of the inning, you could say, was not his fault, but now the home run would be his fault, but the extra runner wouldn't be. Like, there's always that little asterisk on Aaron Nola's struggles that make it so they're defensible in some way, and it's part of the mystifying nature of his output. But even in that case, they managed to recover. Aaron Nola allowed 3 hits, no walks, 2 earned runs over 6 innings, and then Christopher Sanchez came out and allowed 6 hits, no walks, no runs, and 9 strikeouts over 7 innings, and obviously made a little bit of history while he was doing that too. Dodgers Nation, the website, points out that Christopher Sanchez, who will not pitch in Los Angeles, has plenty of Dodgers in his way between his current 44 2/3 scoreless inning streak and the all-time record. He just overtook Clayton Kershaw's 41 innings and has Zach Greinke 1 inning in front of him at 45 2/3. Don Drysdale's 58 straight scoreless is second all-time to Oral Hershiser's 59. So if, you know, things get even crazier here, those are the names you're going to be hearing in relation to Christopher Sanchez. But Liz, does Christopher Sanchez have 14 1/3 more innings of shutout pitching in him? His next start will also be against the Padres, only at home.
Oh, no reason to say no. I mean, why? If he's facing the Padres next, I mean, I think he's got that in him. Like, why at this point? Why wouldn't he? Like, you'd think most pitchers have this type of thing, this type of ability, but they just can't ever get everything to line up correctly. And Christopher Sanchez is just riding a wave, whatever the terminology is. He's just gliding and floating. It's like, you know, it's a Neo in the Matrix when he finally learns all of the stuff he needs to know at the end and he's barely paying attention. That is Christopher Sanchez right now. He's seeing through the Matrix. He's dodging the bullets in bullet time. Like, it's a beautiful thing. It's so cool to watch.
You mentioned The Matrix. My 90s reference will be The Simpsons. In cases like this where you are looking at somebody do a very good thing for a long time and you reach that point where you're like, oh boy, I mean, I want to believe this is going to be a record of some kind, which it already is, but 59 is a long way from 44 and two-thirds. I don't say that to be discouraging. I say that to acknowledge reality and to acknowledge the fact that what Christopher Sanchez has done so far is already incredible and already anomalous and already something to marvel at. And it was very cool, by the way. The Padres didn't, you know, address it or anything. It was a Phillies franchise record that Christopher Sanchez set by overtaking a scoreless inning streak set by Grover Cleveland Alexander in 1911. But you did see a big section of Phillies fans kind of stand up and give him his flowers as he came off the field following breaking the record. And so, you know, just staying at that level for as long as he has is already impressive. Staying on it for 14 and a third more innings just feels like, oh boy, every inning he's not setting the record is a chance for chaos to happen, even if he gets everything right. But when I say I'm going to make a Simpsons reference, in moments like this, I always think back to, and usually you're thinking of this in more of a negative context, but in this case, it's positive. It's Principal Skinner when he says, come on, we all know these children have no future. And they all look at him and he's like, prove me wrong, children. Prove me wrong. Like, hey, this is happening. And I know it seems unlikely that it could keep happening, but until it stops, prove that it will. You know, what reason do we have to think Christopher Sanchez's scoreless streak will ever end? Since, you know, he's just pitching that great.
Yeah. I mean, the last time I remember a stretch of dominance like this, and I finally found it, was Cliff Lee in 2011. Already a great year for the Phillies, a great year for Phillies pitchers as well. But in June 2011, Cliff Lee went 5-0. One run earned, 8 walks, 29 strikeouts, 0.21 ERA over 42 innings. That, I thought, was one of the greatest stretches I would ever see. You know, I watched that and thought, no one's going to do this well. How could they do this well again in this much together? And watching Christopher Sanchez do it, he's been even better. And he's been getting far lesser run support as well.
Yeah, and such is the makeup of this team that even after that performance, you start the next series with your number one starter and one of two aces, Zach Wheeler. So that's kind of a refreshing change as well. Zach Wheeler is projected to start against Justin Robleski of the Dodgers, a left-hander the Phillies will face. But again, remember, that's not really an issue for this team anymore. But yeah, that is why the 2011 season has started to become, I don't know, almost a reference point for these guys. Like you said, that Cliff Lee season was a stat you saw on screen because it was the next comparable one to Sanchez after the Grover Cleveland Alexander scoreless streak. I mean, then you look at the pitching staff in general. I mean, obviously you point to that one in 2011 as one of the best of all time. Roy Halladay, Cliff Lee, Roy Oswalt, Cole Hamels, throw Joe Blanton and Vance Worley in there because they were part of that too.
Oh, man.
But this is... This is also very impressive. You can't say six names that really make you go, wow. Like even in the case of like a guy like Joe Blanton, when he's your fifth starter, you have a really good rotation. In this case, you know, a cycle through the rotation in which Aaron Nola can do what he did in San Diego makes this rotation look so deep. When he doesn't, it feels razor thin. But when he does, it feels like, oh yeah, we get a good pitching start most nights. And then Andrew Painter gets to try his stuff out, and he seems to only be getting better too. But yeah, it's really nice to be able to look at the next team on the schedule as the Dodgers, the best team in baseball, and wanting to keep the momentum you've built against another good team, the Padres, and knowing you just got what you got out of Sanchez, and you can still turn to Zach Wheeler. I mean, this was from Paul Casella on MLB.com. Following his last start, Zach Wheeler said the Phillies' starting rotation is fueled by trying to one-up whoever pitched the previous game. That sounds very... I was like, why does that sound just like the 2011 team? It probably sounds
right?
It sounds like a lot of rotations. And then I thought, oh, yeah, because I'm thinking of the home run contest where they were having a contest to see who could hit the most home runs and have the highest batting average. And I believe it was Cliff Lee with two home runs and a 143 batting average.
He took that in a walk.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So we'll be getting Zach Wheeler, by that sentiment, with whom the Phillies are 6-0 this season, trying to outdo Christopher Sanchez, who in his last start set the Phillies record for consecutive scoreless innings. So, Liz, what's going to happen in Los Angeles tonight? Are the Dodgers in danger?
I mean, the Dodgers are always in danger when Zach Wheeler's on the mound. I mean, I would love to say that they're in danger at other times, but they're a very good team.
Yeah, they've won five in a row. We'll get to them in a second.
Yeah. They won five in a row. They're a pretty worthy foe. They're going to be another team that the Phillies definitely have to prove themselves against. Like, prove me wrong, Phillies. You know, you, not that they haven't shown it, but, you know, before this win, they had lost two series in a row against guys that are over 500. So winning one series isn't quite enough. So they need to go in and, you know, make a statement. And I think they will. I think everyone's feeling really good. I think the good pitching is giving everybody more confidence. You know, I think that's the real catch-22. Like, when the pitching is bad, they need the offense to step up and make them feel like they've got a little bit more room. And when the hitting is bad, they need the pitching to be like, we got you. You know, we will get you. We will make sure we can, you know, as few runs past the home plate as possible for you to win. You know, it's tough for them to actually actively give themselves that space, but it's nice to see it happen like it is now. And so hopefully that'll continue to make the Phillies feel, you know, confident as they move into a really tough opponent.
This is a huge series. I was going to say this is a statement series, and then as you were talking, I realized this is a huge series in that the Dodgers are the top team in baseball and the team that eliminated the Phillies from the postseason last year. They haven't been here since they were eliminated, and they have individuals who have things to prove, or, you know, at least from a, let's say, narrative perspective, quote unquote, things to prove. If you check in with these guys, like, you know, Orion Kerkering, they'll tell you that's not a factor. This is just any other series for me. You know, I'm just trying to build off that. It's what he told Scott Lauber, the Inquirer. But this is a huge series because this is, I think, we are seeing a high functioning Phillies team. Maybe fully weaponized isn't the right term because, you know, I still think you can see more from the offense despite everything. But a high functioning Phillies team that just took a tough series on the road. So this is going to be huge. And, you know, Kerkering, speaking of the bullpen, against the Padres, everybody but Brad Keller gets props for the Padres series too. The Phillies used only five relievers total in San Diego, with Keller, Joan Duran, and Orion Kerkering appearing in two games each. Kerkering struck out five of the seven batters he faced. He allowed only a walk with no hits and no runs. Duran struck out three of seven. He allowed just one hit. From the managerial side, Scott Fransky told Rob Tourneau that the vibes aren't really different from Thompson to Mattingly, Liz. And like Charlie Manuel always said, the players are just, you know, just playing better. He just gave a lot of credit to the players when they said, oh, yeah, what's your managing secret? He'd just be like, well, I have really good players. That's the answer. But Don Mattingly has been more into using, you know, things like using Brandon Marsh and Bryson Stott every day, both of whom just hit lefties now, so that's happening. And he didn't hesitate to reuse two effective relievers in 3 days, and also Brad Keller. But they have played far more teams under 500 than over since the change, too, as I mentioned. I don't think you can make much out of them, but Liz, how much credit do you give the minute discrepancies between Thompson and Mattingly's styles for the team's success?
I think you can give them a little bit of credit. I mean, you can give them as much credit as you want, because thus far we've seen that it's worked. What the team really needed in the transition is they needed someone to sort of, I think, give them a little bit more, like, foundation, a little more groundedness, maybe. You know, they're really small things, but they can add up, you know. Being willing to use these guys every day, being willing to use relievers 2 days in a row, those are the things that we can see. There are lots of other stuff that we don't see, and we have to assume that it's helping. But what we can see is that what he's doing is, they're small things, but they're adding up to be really beneficial for the team overall. You know, I wish we knew a little bit more about what the team was like. It's interesting that they said that the vibes are the same, because that just leads me to believe that there's just what's happening are little changes that are making the difference overall.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a certain amount that you think, all right, well, it's luck, or it's like Jim Salisbury had characterized it, that a shock like this can just stun a team into playing a different way, or like coming into work a little differently because, hey, look, there's a new face. But Mattingly, you know, has done a few things that are maybe different, or things that Rob Thompson wouldn't have done, which we wouldn't have called Rob Thompson wrong for necessarily, but in some cases were things that people disagreed with him about, like Brandon Marsh's playing time, like his reliever usage. And if Don Mattingly is doing something a little differently, then it's kind of part of that refreshing of how the Phillies generally do things, even if you don't see it as a automatic net positive or an automatic net negative. Little changes like this have had a positive effect, I think. And that's you can give credit to that without saying it's the whole shebang, because I think a lot of this you do have to give credit to the players just playing better, and in some cases dramatically so.
Oh yeah. I mean, you didn't have to tear all this down to the studs. I think all they needed was things to look a little different, things to add up a little differently. You know, a fresh coat of paint, some wallpaper. That's all they really needed. And that's kind of what they got. And if I don't think it, like, there should be no criticism involved that that's what they needed, you know, that they just needed some, I mean, quote unquote, small to change things. But whatever it was, it did change things. You know, playing better. It is, I can't believe it's a coincidence that Thompson was fired and they started playing better immediately. That's a, you know, there was a cause and effect, even if we don't know what it was, even if it's, you know, undefinable.
Yeah. So some things may be going right for the Phillies, but the problem is, Liz, the Dodgers, who the Phillies will face this weekend, are doing everything right. From NBC Sports Philly, Los Angeles swept the Rockies by outscoring them 24-10 over the past three games. The Dodgers offense has scored 40 total runs in the last five games.
That's a lot of runs.
There's those 8 runs a game I was referring to earlier. In those five games, the Dodgers are batting .293. Which is second in baseball with 10 home runs. That's second in baseball. The pitching staff has a 2.60 ERA in that span, which is fifth, with top five ranks in WHIP and OBA. So, does that throw any water on it for you, Liz? I mean, you know, the Phillies, they won 3 in a row. This is good. They're coming in. They got the right momentum. Dodgers just always seem to be doing a little bit better. They haven't really had what I would call a rough patch so far this season. They are in the midst of losing Kike Hernandez and Teoscar Hernandez, recently turned to their farm system to fill a few holes in their roster. But I don't think you would say these were season-altering changes for the Dodgers, despite the value that both of those guys can bring to your lineup. I mean, at this point, we're talking about not really being scared of the Padres, but do you have any sort of anxiety or dread about now facing the Dodgers, who are unarguably a better opponent, who are playing like a better opponent, who are getting all the breaks that a team that this good, you know, deserves on some levels, but also just does not seem to have an area where you can really get in? You know, last year in the playoffs, we were like, well, the bullpen's vulnerable, and it was very vulnerable, and you just had to get into that bullpen and you'd be able to beat the Dodgers. And then guess what? They had a fully healthy pitching staff for the first time all season long, and they were able to cover up that hole without ever letting Blake Treinen take the field. So do you feel like there's a obvious way in here on the Dodgers, or are you just trying to play your hardest and hope it's better than their hardest?
That's it. They have to go out there and play their hardest. Like, there's no reason that they should be scared of the Dodgers or any team at this point. We know that they're good enough to beat any team. They just have to actually put it all together at once. And seeing them do that against the Padres was good. That's part of what Don Mattingly has done for the Phillies. He managed to steady them during a period where they needed to be steady. They needed to do well against these bad teams to build themselves back up. So now they're back up. So they have to go out and play their hardest. There's no way in against any of these teams, really. You know, we're still, it's not even June yet. It's almost June. But, you know, some of these teams are still operating with pretty full staffs, with far less problems than they'll have in a few months. And so there's no way in against these teams right now. You have to just go out there and hope that your best is better than their best. And I don't think that's a terrible thing. You know, that's how you learn what a team is and understand what they're going to need going forward.
I'm going to change it to be your current ceiling is higher than their current ceiling, because I think I'd have a hard time making the argument that the Dodgers' best isn't better than the Phillies' best, unfortunately. But that's...
Oh, no, that, I agree with that.
That's not baseball. You know, you're not always, our ceiling is our normal. No, it's not, even if you are the Dodgers. And I think the Phillies, especially when you start a weekend series with Zach Wheeler, and you get to also throw Jesus Luzardo at the Dodgers, you know, who can also give you a great deep start, then I think you're giving yourself a shot, because guys like that are also singularly skilled enough to take down a high-functioning Dodgers offense and give you a shot as though you're playing a worse team. And that's the value a guy like Zach Wheeler brings. But, like you said, the Phillies don't actually, other than any postseason trauma from last year's elimination, which, don't get me wrong, is very present, the Phillies are typically good at handling the Dodgers in the regular season. I mentioned their very strong record against the Padres since 2022, where they're 20-9. They're not that good against the Dodgers, but they are 15-10 in the regular season since 2022. And most recently, they're like 5-1 and 4-2 against them in the last couple of years. So the Phillies have beaten the Dodgers in 9 out of their last 12 regular season games. So expect to hear plenty, though, about the NLDS, including Kerkering's whoopsie that ended it. And like I said, he talked to Scott Lauber in the Inquirer. And I mean, you know, how do you feel about this general approach here, Liz? That Kerkering's treating this like any other road trip, and he says he's trying to build off these bad memories and just, you know, create some more that are better. He expects to keep pitching for the next decade. So he's like, yeah, I mean, there's going to be bad times and there's going to be good games. And that was a bad game, but I'm hoping to pile up a bunch of good ones. So do you feel like, what kind of big moment do you think Kerkering's going to have in this series? Do you think the Dodgers fans are going to be razzing him if he comes into a game? I mean, I can see how Phillies fans would take this, but I don't think everybody takes it that far. So I don't know. How much of a moment do you think it is when Kerkering comes into a game this weekend?
Oh, I don't think it'll be. I mean, the Dodgers won. And then they also won the World Series. So they have no reason to be booing or jeering Kerkering. He helped them.
I'm going to stop you right here. It's not, I mean, jeering, I think we wouldn't have a reason to jeer a Dodgers pitcher who suffered the same fate in like an alternate universe in Philadelphia. But that doesn't mean he's not getting jeered. That doesn't mean people aren't printing out industrial-sized screen caps of that specific error and holding it up behind the home plate or in the outfield until security takes it away from him, or dressing up in his uniform and, like, cosplaying the moment during a tailgate. Like, I can see Phillies, and have seen in some cases, Phillies fans doing all of that.
That's true. That strikes me as really extreme, at least for Los Angeles. But I actually would kind of dig seeing that. I think Kerkering might dig it. Like, look at all the trouble they went through.
Yeah,
I mean, did I really make such an impression? Like, I really like the approach he's taking. You know, I just adore him in general, but he's like, I'm not going to pretend it didn't happen, because it did happen. You know, I'm not going to try and forget it, because it's impossible to forget. You know, I have to come to terms with it, which I have. You know, people are going to ask me about it, and that's fine. You know, I'm talking about it to you now. I'm going to be fine talking about it to anybody. You know, I like that he's gotten over it. He's giving off really positive, like, mature vibes. Not that anyone's ever called him immature, but I would say that for anybody in that position, because not everyone knows how to do that. Not everyone knows how to forgive themselves and move on like that. Some people would continue to punish themselves, and it is a mature thing in general in life to know, to give yourself that kind of grace and be like, it's a big moment. It could have happened at any moment, but it happened then, and it's over, and all I can do is do better in the future. And he certainly has.
Most Phillies fans, including those in comment sections, believe it or not, will tell you that even if Kerkering gets that playoff clean and they get the out, there's absolutely no guarantee they win that game. There's absolutely no guarantee the offense could have come through at some other point and not, you know, led to the moment that led to that play. Like, there's a million other things you can also point to. But at the end of the day, he's going to be the thumbnail on the clip. But like you said, all you hear from the beats right now is that Kirkering has never shied away from talking about this. He has always owned it. And you're right. I think it's the only and best way to approach what was most assuredly a shattering moment for him, unavoidably so. But I think his approach, you never know what's going on in a man's head, but his approach outwardly has been very healthy and very mature. And I think him coming into a game this weekend, I don't think Mattingly would hesitate to bring him into a game. I don't think that's even worth a question. And B, I think it would be therapeutic and will be therapeutic for him. You know, and then there's the question of how it goes, and you know, who knows where that could lead. But ultimately, he would just tell you again, like, it was another day where, I should have done this right if something goes wrong. And if it doesn't, I'm sure you say, like, it feels really good. And whether he admits it or not, it's going to be some kind of closure to an extent. But even then, you risk saying, like, no, the closure is winning the World Series. You know, the Dodgers are just another team that's in the way of it. But I do think personally, it would be good for him to go out and, you know, get three quick outs, and then your last memory at Dodgers Stadium is that you handled your business. So I think it'll be a healthy weekend for Orion Kirkering.
Yeah, 100% agree. He's gonna do great, you know. And now what he's doing is, instead of just time that he's putting between him and that moment, he's now putting actual baseball between him and that moment. He's now, like, officially moving on the road to somewhere else, on the road to the future. Because before it was just time and regular baseball, but now he's there actually finishing it, you know, finishing something in his mind, going there and leaving without the world ending. You know, he's able to make some new memories there, at least have some memories there that are more recent.
Game one on Friday will be on Apple TV, Liz, which means not TV. It is the last time the Phillies are scheduled to appear on the service this season, but we still have, I believe, the second half. They are still scheduling the game, so there's a very good chance they will appear on Apple TV again, the monthly price of which has doubled since Friday Night Baseball debuted, from $6.99 to $12.99 a month. But, you know, Liz, we're in year five of Apple TV's 7-year deal for MLB. Why is this still an obstacle when it's announced a game will be on Apple TV? Why is it not just a normalized platform for baseball at this point?
Because it costs a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, that's the answer.
It's like a whole, and plus, like, we have MLB TV. This is now like a whole other step. Like, you've got your cable, you know, you've got your local, you know, your local team. If you're a fan of your local team, you've got your local sports network you can watch. If you're a fan of a team in another city, you watch it on MLB TV. Now this is a third thing. It was the same thing with any other game on another streaming platform. It's different if it's on TNT or whatever. That's fine. You can access that. But when it's on a streaming service like this, it is another thing. Yet another thing that we have to do that's different, that's out of our, like, someone on Blue Sky was talking recently, asking people to reply with the most annoying, like, online internet inconveniences. And that is what this, you know, adds up to. It's like when a website you've just visited didn't even give any information to, a website you've just visited sends you an email. How did they get that? I don't know. I think it's Chrome's fault. And I have all of my stuff built into Chrome, but I can't change it. Like, these are the types of things that are inconvenient. Like, imagine, like, having to log into something every single time. Every three times I open up my freaking computer, I have to log in. Why? They told me to pick a really long password. Now I have to type it in, like, three times a week. Just when I want to open my computer to make one change on something? Like, these are the types of inconveniences that drive people up the wall. And this on MLB is yet another one. We just want things to be normal.
Well, speaking of inconveniences, they're about to solve the problem of logging into various platforms by not having baseball at all in 2027.
Yeah.
How's that for a pivot? Because as the Phillies and Dodgers get set to play this weekend, this week, The MLBPA and the owners both submitted proposals for their forthcoming CBA negotiations on Wednesday. The Major League Baseball Players Association submitted their proposal to the league, focusing on restructuring revenue sharing in lieu of a salary cap or floor. Mark Normandin broke it down on Baseball Prospectus that the proposal came down to a lot of points. A couple of them were expanding the pre-arbitration bonus pool, hiking up the minimum salary to $1.5 million, adjusting salary arbitration, getting rid of the qualifying offer, increasing the luxury tax threshold, and having the penalties reduced. And then on Thursday, Major League Baseball owners submitted their proposal. From the Associated Press, Major League Baseball owners made their long-expected salary cap proposal to the Players Association on Thursday, a system the union has vowed never to accept. You know, Liz, when you're in a CBA negotiation and people start referring to vows, there's a sort of ancient and archaic and epic nature to that that makes you feel like, yeah, I mean, we're pretty entrenched on two opposite sides of this thing if we're talking about vows. Like, that's pretty far gone.
It is. I mean, and that's the thing. The MLB Players Association, it is a vow and it's a serious vow. And the word vow is used specifically. It's from the moment the PA was started and it started to work for players' rights, there no salary cap. No matter if they want to give us a floor, no cap. Anything that involves a cap means you are limiting what the players can earn. And that is that they are the only league still that has resisted this. And it is for their better, I think. They're still not the most profitable sport. With so many games, it's hard to be. But like, they're better. MLB is better because of this. But a salary cap is a short-sighted proposal. And MLB is always going to start. It's always going to start there because it's the most they can ask for. It is the biggest thing, and so they have to ask for it first.
MLB's
proposal. I always find that encouraging because it has to be in their first proposal, and it's eventually going to have to drop out of the proposals because the Players Association will not have it.
MLB's proposal would cap spending in 2027 at $245.3 million.
No.
Using figures for luxury tax payrolls that include $20.1 million for benefits and the pre-arbitration bonus pool. This is from Mark Normandin. The Los Angeles Dodgers had a $415.2 million payroll on opening day this year, which is $170 million over the proposed cap. They have all these ideas about, you can putting money in escrow for players and also phasing out these contracts over 10 years. You know who else is over that salary cap is your friends and mine, the Philadelphia Phillies. Love to see the reaction to a roster getting hacked apart that it was finally exciting. The team was so willing to spend on just a real good feeling. Baseball owners, Liz, haven't proposed a firm cap since 1994. You don't remember what happened?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a seven and a half.
They didn't play baseball for a while.
7.5 month strike happened. Canceled the World Series. First time, 90 years. In fact, you mentioned this is where the owners always start. Well, the cap is pretty much a non-starter, Pittsburgh outfielder Brian Reynolds said, according to the Associated Press. 7.5 months, huh? Liz, how long do you think the next stoppage will be?
It's either going to be non-existent or it'll be real long. That is my guess. Jim Bowden, who I hate, one of my least favorite baseball analysts, said
we're
something
gonna get
to that
Jim,
make...
yeah.
Oh, okay. Then I'll back off for now. Never mind.
Please. That's fine.
Okay. I mean, Mark in his supplemental newsletter, Mark Normandin, Marvin Miller's Mustache, excellent, $5 a month. You should subscribe. Excellent labor analysis. Brought up Bowden and said that he didn't think that a salary cap is worth staging a lockout for. Like, straight
Bowden,
up.
Of all people.
I know. One of the most owner-friendly guys says it's not worth it. The money you're going to lose is too much for something you're literally never going to get. That's the thing. The players are willing to go as long as it takes. And if they want, and if the If MLB wants to use that to their advantage, they can, because they could keep that in there till the very, very, very end. And once they take it out, the players are so tired that they just like, fine, everything else is fine. And so that's always a risk. And that happened a little bit last time. The players were just so exhausted after so long, they really wanted to get back. And you have to hope there's a little bit more solidarity this time to just being a firm no and then continuing to maintain the values, recognize that the salary cap is what is a huge thing, but there's so much more underneath it that has an effect on the day-to-day lives of players. That's always my concern, is that they're concerned about the smaller stuff, because the salary cap affects every player, especially the lower income guys. But making their lives better between AAA and Major League Baseball is such a huge thing. You know, making sure the players earning the minimum are earning enough, not just enough, but earning money that is commensurate with their talent and the time that it's taken them to get to where they are, which is about what increasing the minimum salary is about. I really love that proposal. I think it's long since time to raise that, because but Bryce Harper's making millions and millions of dollars. And while people are going to see him, it's not like they're not going to see, you know, I'm trying to think of a Phillies player who's not making very much.
Justin Crawford.
Edmundo Sosa.
Justin Crawford.
Justin Crawford. He's part of it, and he's also adding value to the team. That's important, you know? I like that that is an important thing to them, and I hope that they keep, you know, ensuring that that amount stays high. And again, they continue to make gains on the other small things. Like, I mean, I know when the AAA had their collective bargaining agreement, which I think is going to be up in a couple of years, and I'll be very interested to see how that goes. But there were improvements across the board for players in that, you know, AAA is a difficult environment. But, you know, players who make money on the low end are suffering in also different ways in a world that requires them to pay a lot of money, especially rookies who get stuck with the bill a whole bunch.
This is why Rob Manfred and his cronies said their plan was to get in the ears of younger players and be like, hey, these guys in charge of your union who are making all this money, you know, they don't have your best interests at heart. They're looking out for themselves, and really, you know, encourage them to split so that there would not be, you know, union within the union. You know, I wonder where that term comes from.
Solidarity.
So, you know, that is why you attack that, because it sounds like you're making a point, but the long game is, no, this work we're doing as the players' union is for all of the players, even though some of us are not making the most money yet. Players want expanded free agency and salary arbitration rights. They want to almost double the major league minimum, increasing the money high revenue teams share with the less wealthy clubs, and establish penalties for teams that drop below payroll floors. MLB's proposal did not address these issues.
No revenue sharing, no nothing, which shows that they're just tossing out whatever they're ready to go. They're ready whenever, you know, they're ready now, but they're not going to show that they're ready. They're just going to throw out something that has crap in it because they're not taking this seriously yet.
Yep. There was a response to the owner's proposal from the interim director of the Major League Baseball Players Association, Bruce Mayer. He said, yesterday, MLBPA presented a comprehensive package of proposals designed to improve compensation for players at all levels and to incentivize and reward competition on the field. The owners responded today with a demand for a salary cap system, something generations of players have fought against. The last time the owners made such an explicit push for a cap over 30 years ago, it led to the longest work stoppage in Major League Baseball history. For generations, our members have fought against cap systems because they harm players at all levels, erode or eliminate contractual guarantees, pit player against player, lead to more work stoppages, not less, and get worse for players over time. They go on to explain more reasons why, and you know, I think it's the players' union, and this was another point Mark Normandin talked about. The players' union is not always very forthcoming with what they're proposing and like the ideas that they're negotiating with. But this time, so far, there's been a lot of clarity where they're just explaining like, this is what we submitted, this is what we think, and this is what we want. But at the end of the day, what you're really seeing here is that these two sides are very, very far apart. And something to remember that I guess this is more of an opinion, but ball players want to be on the field. Manfred wants to be in the boardroom. All you ever hear is what a shark he is at the negotiating table. This is why he has his job. There will never be another commissioner who likes baseball and wants the best for baseball. It's all about making the owners happy, and that's what Rob Manfred's job is. He would prefer to be in the boardroom. Have you listened to any of Rob Manfred's quotes the past few years when they make it into the headlines 5-6 times a year? The man doesn't know what he's talking about when he's talking about baseball. He can say,
he sounds
like an AI.
He really does. He sounds like an AI.
Remember on opening day where they were interviewing him and were like, hey, when was the last time you're at opening day? And he was like, oh, in the late 80s. And you're just doing the math like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, as a fan. And he said, yeah, well, I was working for baseball. It's like, so not as a fan. Okay, this guy does not have an appreciation for baseball, which would be totally fine if he wasn't the commissioner of baseball.
Yeah.
So end of the day.
That is the problem.
Yeah, that's we'll have plenty of more conversations like this in the future. I will just say that, we mentioned Justin Crawford's name, and I just want to jump back and say, yeah, he hasn't had the most offensive success lately, but that catch he made in center field this past weekend was absolutely staggering. Just a phenomenal job, and there's a reason every player in the infield, most enthusiastically Bryson Stott, stopped and applauded for him while after he made that play. And secondly, The Athletic wrote, to meet the new cap and floor that MLB proposed, MLB counts 12 teams that would need to grow their payroll by a combined $617 million for 2027 under this proposal. The Athletics, good luck. Chicago White Sox, Cincinnati Reds, Cleveland Guardians, Rockies, Marlins, Brewers, Twins, Pirates, Cardinals, Rays, and Nationals. But of course, these owners, you know, I've seen some fans say like, aha, I love the idea of angry owners having to spend more. No, the owners want this. This is a win for them. If the floor comes with the cap, that's what they want. Like that's the idea. Another 8 teams would need to cut payroll by a combined $578 million. Braves, Red Sox, Dodgers, Mets, Yankees, Padres, Blue Jays, and yes, the Philadelphia Phillies. So, Liz, the idea is that this cap and floor makes all teams somewhat competitive, more fairly disperses the talent throughout the league, gives more fans a more watchable team, generating more revenue for the team's payroll, a healthy ecosystem. But as you said, Jim Bowden stood up and said that, as a guy who's always supported the idea of a salary cap, as you said, it's not worth losing baseball. And that he actually also pointed out that trying to build a competitive roster without a huge payroll and, you know, not being able to do that is a skill issue as an executive, which, I'd say
that's exactly it.
A very fair point. Evan Drellich at The Athletic says it's not about the salary cap and floor, as you said, for the owners. It's about increasing franchise values so that when they eventually sell their teams, they're as valuable as they could possibly be. And that's ultimately what every owner's looking for. Yes, even John Middleton, who, you know, thankfully we haven't heard from for the past couple of weeks, but, he was not on a great run of publicly made comments and perception. But fortunately, when the Phillies are playing well, we don't have to rely on John Middleton quotes to be the news. So, yeah, this is going to be a long and drawn out fight. I'm with you. I hope that this doesn't happen at all. But how much of a chance do you really think there is to avoid an actual stoppage, either a strike or a lockout of some kind? Like what are the real chances that this winds up getting resolved?
Right now in June, 6 months out, almost June, six months out from when the agreement ends, I'm going to say right now it seems like there's very little chance that they'll be able to avoid a lockout. You know, MLB isn't even being serious. They didn't make any serious proposals, while the PA is just like, here's all of our homework and all of the work that we did in a separate packet. Does anyone want to check it? So I like that about them. But at the moment, the response from MLB does not bode well. But I've got to give the PA credit under Bruce Meyer. He's not, you know, the guy that everyone wanted, but he's the guy that did the negotiating for them last time. And now he's in charge. He's an actual guy who knows what he's doing. And Tony Perez had his pluses and minuses, no matter, you know, how you, even though he left under extreme shame and embarrassment.
So weird.
It is so weird. When you said, you know, interim head Bruce Meyer, I'm like, oh, yeah, Tony Clark is not there anymore. I mean, and I feel good about that. I really don't think that player unions should be run by former players. I think they should be run by lawyers because the players, the people in the union have to work hard to gain solidarity. But the people who do the negotiating have to be lawyers and have to know what they're doing. And so I feel good that Bruce Meyer's at the head of this. He's always known what he's doing, and now he's got the reins. He just needs a Max Scherzer. He needs a guy who's willing to say things on behalf of the players. Not that, was it Brian Johnson? Brian Mitchell? I don't remember. Said that, you know, was able to speak up. You need a bigger player. And that's what Max Scherzer was. You know, he was on the Players Council. He was sort of speaking on their behalf. But you need a guy, a well-known player, who's willing to say some things that might be not incendiary, quote unquote, but like telling the truth about how things are. And so Bruce Meyer just needs a guy who's willing to work with the press in that way, who's willing to give him the quotes, and who's willing to say everything in really plain language for the fans. That's how they get the fans on board, is to get the players involved and get them saying, this is what we are, this is what we want. And they did a decent job with that 5 years ago. And I think now it'll be even more. It'll be even better than it was with them, you know, getting their message out and making sure the fans know what they want.
Mayer's response to the owner's proposal also included the phrase, billionaire owners are not seeking to cap their profits or set their values, only player salaries. This isn't out of generosity or a desire to protect the game's well-being. It's a play to control costs, increase profits, and maximize franchise values, all at the expense of players' past, present, and future. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think Mayer's got the right tone here. I think the union's got the right approach. Everything that, as Mark Normandin, who, again, should be an expert you follow as this topic comes to dominate baseball coverage, if you choose to continue paying attention, which no one would blame you if you didn't. I don't look forward to having more discussions of this kind on this show. But he did say that all of the things he said, this is what the players' union should be going for right now, they did. That is, so they are making their stand, and we'll see how this plays out as the weeks and months go by. But fortunately, we do still have baseball. And this weekend, the Phillies will be playing the Dodgers in Los Angeles with a couple of late start times. So get ready to stay up late this weekend as the Phillies and Dodgers square off at 10:15 tonight. As I said, Zach Wheeler's starting this series off. He of the 4-0 record and the 1.67 ERA. He'll be facing Justin Robleski, a lefty for the Dodgers. He's got a 3.07 ERA for them this year. Wheeler's the only pitcher that is currently listed among the Phillies' probable pitchers. You throw Lizardo and Painter out there because that's, you know, who would be due up next given the rotation, but that information has not been confirmed or put out there yet. So all that we do know is that on Saturday, first pitch will be at 10:10 in Los Angeles, and the Phillies will be facing Roki Sasaki, the unwelcome presence from the National League Division Series last year, who, again, another statement you could make right there, because Sasaki's ERA is scraping up against 5 so far in 2026, so somebody you could maybe take advantage of here. And then the Sunday matinee will be at 4:10 p.m. The Phillies will face Yoshinobu Yamamoto. That's not going to be fun either. But, like we said, the Phillies have been playing at their best lately. Certainly in San Diego, they were able to get the job done. Even if the offense wasn't super present, they got enough of it, and they can lean on that starting pitching, which will continue on Friday night with Zach Wheeler. That'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to my co-host, Liz Rocher. You can get new episodes of Hittin' Season 3 times a week from your local podcast shop. You can also find bonus Phillies podcasts at the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittinseason. There were no bonus podcasts this week as I was away, but we will be making up for that with new episodes of Absolutely Hammered and The Dirty Inning. I wanted to note, caught a Mexican League game while I was out west. Saw our dear friend, Didi Gregorius, playing down in Tijuana.
My gosh.
Which was fantastic.
Didi loves the game, man.
It was Star Wars night in Tijuana, and they would announce the players, and then the most horrific AI version of that player as a Jedi.
No.
Fantastic. No notes, among other just absolutely exquisite parts of Mexican League Baseball. I encourage everyone to catch a game if they ever get the opportunity.
Oh man, now I really want to.
Well, I'm Justin Clue, and from WHYY, that's The Ball Game. We'll talk to you next time on Hitting Season.